Good morning, I'm Donna, I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Dot, for everything, for picking me up at the airport and for... I want to thank the committee for inviting me to come and participate this weekend. I'm really looking forward to the rest of today, and I really enjoyed last night listening to Dawn. I didn't get to get here until yesterday evening, so I missed the earlier events, but I'm going to be looking forward to hearing those on CD. It's just such a it's a pleasure and a privilege to get invited and to get to participate in things like this. And, I get to meet up with old friends that I, don't get to see often enough and make new ones. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a family that is, wider than anything I would have imagined. I have relationships in this program that go, beyond anything I have with my own family. And that's one of the great pleasures of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that isn't what I was looking for when I came here. That wouldn't have even appealed to me. Back when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just such a mess then. But to have the life that I have today is just amazing to me in every possible way. I'm just going to get on with it this morning. I get to share with you in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. And, that's my privilege to do so. I'm a Montana drunk. I come from the old cowboy bars in Montana, where I did most of my drinking. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background before I get into that part. I come from an alcoholic home, and my dad was the alcoholic in our house, and there was a lot of violence and beatings and guns going off in the middle of the night and all kinds of crazy insanity. And I was the oldest of four kids in that home, and there was just nothing but terror happening in that house. There was every kind of abuse that can happen in alcoholic homes was going on in our house. And I'm a kid growing up in this house, and I qualified for the program of Alateen and then Al-Anon long time before I ever picked up a drink, because I believed that the reason those things were happening was because there was something wrong with me. And I thought if I could find some way to be good enough or smart enough, or have, be the right person, that they would love me and God would protect me and I'd be safe. And that's what I figured out all by myself about how life was supposed to work. Well, that just didn't happen. And it didn't happen because my parents were really sick people. My mom and dad did the very best they could. It was a far cry from being very good, but it was the best that they could do. And I have come to understand that and have compassion for that in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, that is something I wasn't looking for when I came here either. But that's been a special byproduct of working those steps and doing a lot of inventories on what my background was really like. When I was, there was all of this crazy chaos going on in our home. And when I was 17, my dad got caught. And he thought he was going to go to jail for some of the things that was happening in our house. And so we ended up leaving town in the middle of the night and moving to Northern California. Now, it's 1967. And it's Northern California. It had the potential of being very interesting. But I'm trying to be good. I'm just trying to be good. I'm figuring if I can be good enough and, I can make things right somehow. There's a place in the Big Book that I love so much, and what it says is that we suffered from the delusion that we could wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if we only managed well. I think it says out of this life, if you only manage well. And that's I suffered from that delusion from the time I was a little kid, because I thought if I could do it better, that I could somehow change my surroundings. If I did it right, we were talking about this morning. I still suffer from that delusion. I still think that if I can do it right, I can make things happen the way I need them to be. So, we moved to Northern California, and I'm just, nose to the grindstone. I'm just trying to be this good little girl. And what happened was my parents moved around quite a lot, and they were, very unsettled, and my dad was a really miserable man, and it was always going to be better over there somehow. Anyway, I ended up making another trip back up to Montana around Christmas time, and I had a girlfriend up there. I just turned 18. And I had a girlfriend up there who was having a Christmas party, and I went to this Christmas party this night, and I met God's will for my life. Now, I met this man, and this is what I knew about him, was that he was stationed in Charleston, South Carolina. He was in the Navy, and that's a long ways from Billings, Montana, and I thought, maybe if I go with this guy, I can make a life that's different for me than the life that I had. And he asked me to marry him. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but if somebody asks you to marry him, you can't say no. You know, that's rude. That's... I always say I've been very, very careful about the men I've married. I've married anyone that asked. So anyway, he asked me to marry him. I knew him 3 weeks. That's how long. It's crazy when I think about it. I mean, it's just insane. But from the time we got married, we moved to Charleston, and we had five children in 6 years from the day we said I do. You know, it was insanity. And, you know, I'm a crazy person. I was 25 years old and I had 5 little kids. And people like me shouldn't be, you know, trying to keep houseplants alive, never mind 5 little kids. And, you know, I had no solutions for living. I had not found one single thing that made me feel okay. I was carrying with me this mountain of anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets. And that's who I was. That's me. That's what I'm made of. And I'm trying to play house, you know. I'm being a mom, and I'm being a wife, and I'm trying to do the best. There's this little story like a little picture of what I went to that relationship with. This was one of my, you know, coping skills or whatever. This is resource of information. When I got married and had all those children. When I was a kid growing up back in Billings, we lived out in the country, and my mom used to buy her eggs from the guy that lived down the road that had a whole bunch of chickens. So when the egg cartons were empty in our house, you didn't throw them away, you put them on top of the refrigerator. And when she had like 3 or 4, she'd go down the road and buy the eggs and, you know, use the same cartons. And so I really didn't think about this a lot. I'd been married about 6 months, and I had this big stack of egg cartons on top of my refrigerator. And one day my husband said to me, "What are you saving those for?" And I said, "I don't know, that's where they go." You know? What I was doing. I was trying to do all the stuff that I saw that was not nonviolent, you know. I was trying to do what the grown-ups did, and when the grown-ups said you put the egg cartons on the fridge, then that's what we did, you know. I didn't think, like, do I want to model my life after my parents' life, you know, not really. I didn't think, like, do I know anybody that has any chickens? I didn't think about this. I just knew that, you know, that's what you do. So, anyway, I'm married, I'm 25 years old, and I have 5 little children, 4 little girls and 1 boy. And we had then gotten out of the Navy and moved back to Montana. And, you know, things were crazy. And they were crazy because I was crazy. And, you know, we didn't have a good marriage. We didn't have anything really going on for ourselves. But we definitely had a lot of children, a lot of responsibility. Well, my oldest child was 6 and the youngest was 9 months old, my husband left. And that was probably a good thing. And I went to work in the cowboy bars. And just as sure as I'm standing here this morning, when I started working in those bars and drinking booze on a regular basis, what I found when I put booze in me was a power greater than myself that made life work for me for the first time. When I could put alcohol in me, it made me feel happy, joyous, and free. You know, I could get away from all of those things, you know, the mountain, the anger, the guilt, the fear, the shame, and the self-loathing, and the secrets. I could just escape from all that. It made it just go away for a little while. All of those things, the memories that I ran from as a kid, you know, all of those secrets that I carried around with me. Alcohol took care of those things for me, and it was my higher power. There's a place in the book that says that many of us don't have to drink the length of time or take the amount that others do, and it says it's particularly true with women. It says we often become the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few short years. And that's exactly what I was like and what happened to me. It was like throwing a match in a bucket of gasoline. I mean, the minute I started drinking, I was in trouble with alcohol. I was a blackout drinker. You know, if you're a blackout drinker, there's just nothing more annoying or embarrassing than waking up the next morning and having somebody say to you, "Don't you remember what you did last night?" I mean, those are words that if you're a blackout drinker, you've heard them as many times as I have. I can remember it standing there going, "Geez, I don't think I've ever even really thought that about your husband." you know. Oops. It's just terrible. It's just terrible. It's so embarrassing. It's so humiliating. The truth of it is, you know, the truth is, I drug my family through the disease of alcoholism, and that's something I don't ever want to forget. And that's something I get a chance to talk about whenever I get invited to tell my story. And the reality of it is, my family suffers from the disease of alcoholism, and some of my children don't have that disease, but they suffer from it as well. They suffer from the ism. And, you know, my Polly P is my sponsor. And Polly has told me for a long time that my children's problems might have my name on it, but their solution has their name on it. And that has really helped me a lot, you know. And that's not to say, you know, look, this is your problem, get over it. That's not what that means at all. What it means is that they have their own higher power, and they get to find their own solution for the things that eat them up. My daughters are adult women now. They have children of their own, and I still see the legacy of alcoholism that works in them, you know. There, I heard a guy one time talk about children who grow up in a home, in an alcoholic home, develop what he called computer eyes. And he said that when you walk in the door at night, in a second, they can boom, 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 boom. They can figure you out, and they know exactly what's going on. That, you know, is she happy? Is she sad? Is she mad? Did she have a good day? Did she have a bad day? Are we going to play tonight, or do I go to my room and hide out? And, you know, to gauge how you live around the perception that you have of another person who is crazy, by the way, makes anybody just as sick as you can get. And that's what happened to my children, living with me as an alcoholic, you know. That's what happened to me, living with my dad as an alcoholic. This is a disease that people suffer from that don't even have it. And you know, I don't ever want to forget. If I was trying to raise my children today, CPS would be knocking on my door, Child Protective Services. I'm the kind of mom that neglected and abused and loved and cherished my kids all at the same time. You know, I'm the mom who would walk in the door one night and wrap my arms around them and tell them how gorgeous and wonderful they were and how much I loved them and how beautiful and wonderful they were. And the next night I might walk in and scream my head off or smack somebody because there's a shoe in the middle of the floor. You know, you just never know what you're going to get with alcoholism. And that's the way I was as a mom. Those are the things that you live with, you know. If it wasn't for the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have nothing left but the guilt. And I have plenty of that. You know, I am a work in progress when it comes to that. I am not free from the guilt. You know, I believe and depend on our promises that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I believe that that will happen for me one day. And to some extent, it has happened to me, you know, to some extent, to a good extent, actually. But there are still days when the guilt and remorse, you know, I still feel responsible for a lot of things because I am responsible for a lot of things. I think there's a difference between being responsible and being to blame. You know, I can take responsibility for what my actions were, but I don't have to die under that load of guilt anymore. That nothing, because there's no undoing it. You know, there's no undoing it. There's, for 24 years now, I've been doing things on a different basis, and that is the best I can hope for. And I'm grateful that our program gives us new ways to live, you know. Not only have I not had to be that person for 24 years, I have been a different person for 24 years. I have been, you know, more spiritually based. I have been a softer, kinder person than I've ever been able to be before. And I have a stronger reliance on a higher power than I've ever had before. So, you know, those are the things that I depend on. And, you know, if you want to know when the guilt and fear and remorse goes away, I'll let you know when it happens. But it hasn't completely gone away for me, not entirely. I was a cowboy drunk. I was just bouncing in and out of those bars all the time, and I was out causing a lot of ruckus. I hit AA for the first time in February of 1981. I was living with a guy that was a drummer in a country rock band, and he wasn't, you know, a pillar of the community or anything. But one morning he said to me, "Don't you remember what you did last night?" And he said, "You know, man, you got to do something. You know, man, you got to do something about your drinking because your drinking is really getting you in trouble." And so he said, why don't you go to AA? And to my knowledge, I don't believe I had ever heard of AA at that point. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wanted to keep him around. He was another him that I wanted. So I went to A&A. I found out where they had one meeting a week in Red Lodge, this little town I was living in. And, you know, I got dressed and went to see the A&As. And I went into that meeting, and there were people in there who were staying sober, and that blew my mind. I didn't expect to find people staying sober. I expected to find people who were trying not to drink, because that's what I knew about, you know, you just try not to drink. There's a deal that, you know, one of the big mistakes that I made was that I thought that drinking was my problem. I really thought that if I could just stop drinking, that I could, you know, stop some of the insanity and the crazies would stop. What I didn't realize is that I didn't have a life that was worth living before I found booze. You know, what I had was this mess. I had the mountain. I had that anger and guilt and fear and shame and self-loathing and secrets, and that's what I'm made of. And that's who I was before I put booze in me. So when I take away the only thing that has made it okay for me to live in my skin, which is alcohol, it isn't long before the mountain is back in full force, but so is all that stuff that I've been doing as an alcoholic woman, right here in my face. And, you know, what happened for me was I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I would stay here until the pain of being sober was worse than the fear of getting drunk. And I would go drink again and again and again. And I did that for 7 years. I probably had to raise my hand as a newcomer, you know, I don't know, 30 times over a period of 7 years. It was a crazy ride in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was really hard for me to figure this thing out. Of course, I didn't ask anybody for help, you know. I didn't get a sponsor. I read the steps. They looked to me to be fairly simplistic. You know, there's nothing really complicated there. So I thought I kind of had that figured out. But I used to hear things in meetings that I didn't understand altogether. You know, there was one old guy in Billings who used to come to meetings all the time. He was this tall, skinny cowboy, always dressed in black, had manure on his boots, had a big old chunk of spit chew in his lip, you know. And he would say things like, you know, when it comes to pain and sobriety, sometimes you just got to be like the mule in the hailstorm. You just got to hunker down and take it. And I thought, God, I was really hoping for more than that, you know. Really? Is that it? And he was the first guy I ever heard say this. He said, when it came to drinking, I was like the tomcat making love to the skunk. He said, I hadn't had all I wanted, but I had all I could stand. But wow, you people are weird, you know. So I was going in and out of AA, and I didn't understand what was going on. And what happened for me was that I was just, my guts would, you know, I'm being a good AA member. I'm pouring coffee. I'm reading how it works at meetings. That's what I watch you. That's what you do. People around, you have commitments, they pour coffee, or they wash coffee cups, or they read how it works. That's how you can tell the AA members from the people who aren't really paying attention, you know. And so I'm doing that. I'm pouring coffee and I'm reading how it works, and nothing is helping this big old hole I've got going on inside of me. Nothing is making that better. And I would stay here until I couldn't stand one more stinking lousy minute sober. And then I would go drink. And always I said, I'm going to get drunk tonight and tomorrow I'll go back to AA and I'll really try. And it doesn't work that way. You know, I can't do that. Once I give up my sobriety, it's anybody's bet whether or not I'll ever get back. You see it happen in the rooms all the time. You know, our book tells us that you'll come to the place where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. And what that means to me is that I can know that this is a good idea for me to be a sober person, but I don't have the power to implicate that, implement that. I can't create my sobriety. I can want it all I've got. There was an old guy living in Montana. He used to say that you can sit in a chicken coop till your butt falls off. It won't make you a chicken. And he said that it's the same way in AA. You can sit in meetings day in and day out, and it won't give you recovery. It won't give you sobriety. I was in this long journey of trying to find that out, you know, and by going in and out and in and out and in and out, I ended up losing my children as a result of my drinking. They went to visit their dad over Christmas, and they stayed. They never came back. They didn't come back until they were grown. And I'm really glad I didn't know that. I remember thinking that it would be 6 months maybe, because he came back and told me, you need to get your act together, and when you get well, they'll come home. And I thought, you know, 6 months will be good enough. I had no idea how truly sick I was or how long it was going to be before I got sober. It was 2 more years after they left before I finally got sober. What ended up happening was, you know, I was trying as hard as I could to stay sober those last 2 years, and I could put together a little time and then I'd drink, and then I'd put together some time and then I'd drink, and it was like that over and over and over again. And I was still trying to do it my way. At one point in there, I went to treatment, and treatment gave me 28 days, and that's something I couldn't get on my own, and so I really wanted to hold on to that. And I came out of treatment and I went to AA meetings. I went to meetings every day. Every day, at least one or two a day. And I did okay for about 6 months, and I was hanging in there pretty good, and I had a friend that had moved to Hawaii, and she offered for me to come over and stay with her and get a job. I needed to make some money so I could get a house and get my kids back. And I'm sober now, 6 months sober, so I'm getting close, I think. I'm getting close to being able to get them back. So what happened was I went to Kona and I got a couple of jobs and I did exactly that. I'm making money and I'm saving money and I'm getting ready. I had a little over a year of sobriety and I invited my oldest daughter to Kona. And I told her at the end of our visit, I said, you know, baby, I got a bunch of money saved. I'm ready to come home now and get a house and you guys can move home. And she said, no, Mom, we don't want to live with you anymore. And when she said that, I lost my reason for staying sober, you know. It just broke my heart. And when she left, it wasn't 2 weeks and I was drinking again. And I'm still going to meetings. And in Kona, they had this really annoying practice where they said, is there anyone here for their first, second, or third meeting since their last drink? And then everybody would look at me, see if I'm going to raise my hand today. And I just hated it. You know, I was so angry. And I was, you know, I'd stay sober for a week and get drunk for a week and stay sober for a day, and you know, it was just on and off and on and off, and 6 more months of that before I finally got sober. And I was still going to meetings. I went to 2 or 3 meetings a day. I was sitting in the back and I was so angry. I was so angry that everybody else, I seemed to me like everybody else could have this thing, but I couldn't do anything to help myself. You know, I just couldn't get it. So one night in particular, I was sitting in the meeting and this old guy, not that old, he was one of our long-timers, he had about 20 years, and he was leading the meeting, but I hated Frank. That's probably why I called him old. I couldn't stand him. He was always picking on me, it seemed like. You know, he was always asking me. I remember he said to me one night, well, what are you doing for your sobriety? And I said, well, I pray a lot. And he goes, yeah, well, you and your God are going to get drunk. And I was like, what? I can't believe you said that to me. You know, I was just furious with him. And really, he was just trying to knock me over, you know. He was just trying to knock me off a center so maybe I'd do something different. Well, he was leading the meeting that night, and towards the end of the meeting, he said, is there anyone here that has a burning desire? And Frank looked at me, and I just blew up. You know, I just, yeah. My hand went in the air, and I said, yeah, I got a burning desire for you, buddy. I said, you know what? You people make me sick. You know, you're always telling me that sober is better, and sober doesn't feel better to me. I hate this. I hate the way I feel. I hate my life. It's not, you know, I just kind of, bleh, just barfed all over the meeting. And when I shut up, there was kind of a silence fell over the room, and then somebody said, right on, Donna, keep coming back. And I thought, man, you people are really screwed up. Seriously ill. And after the meeting that night, there was like this little Mr. AA Sunbeam, you know. He had 1 year, Mr. 1 year of sobriety, and he was so happy he could hardly stand himself. He was just on fire with AA. And he came up to me, and I said, you know, I don't know why this program won't work for me, but it just won't work. And he goes, well, how many days has it been since you drank? And I said, 45 days. And that's a long time if you don't have an answer or anything going on, you know. And Jeff goes, well, what makes you think it isn't working? And I said, was I going too fast for you, Jeff? You know, let me tell you, I hate this. I hate the way I feel. My life is going nowhere. It is over. It is over. I am miserable. I can't see tomorrow. And he just picked up, this was a complete God shot. I don't even know how somebody with a year of sobriety would know this, but he picked up the 12 and 12. And he opened it to the seventh step, and he showed me one sentence. And that sentence says, in every case, pain was the price of admission into a new life. In every case. And I just thought, okay, whatever. You know, maybe what I'm going through isn't for nothing. Honestly, it just bought me one more day. The next night, I went to a meeting, and I met a lady that changed my whole life. This was the most amazing experience. She had just hit the island that day. She was 27 years sober, right around there. She was pushing 70 years old, and her husband had just died of brain cancer. And she had some long-term sober friends that lived in Kona, and when Johnny died, they told Phyllis, why don't you just come over here and stay with us for a month and just let us love on you. You need to rest up a little bit, you know. So she hopped on a plane and hit the island, and they stuck her up behind the podium that night. This lady was amazing. She had an energy about her that just lit up the room, you know. She had this gorgeous smile, and she was just electric. She loved AA. She loved drunks. She didn't care if you were drunk or sober. She just loved Alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous. And she stood up there that night, and she told my story. She was 36 when she got sober. I was 36 then. She talked about the children. She talked about neglecting and abusing and loving and cherishing her kids. She had two little boys when she got sober. And she said her youngest was 4 years old. And she said he stuttered really bad when he talked. And she said every time that little guy opened his mouth and tried to say something, I felt like I had done that to him. And I knew what it felt like to have all that remorse and guilt over your children, what you did or didn't do. And she talked about that without a lot of drama. She just told it, you know. She also, the biggest part about it, though, was she talked about the mountain. She talked about who she was before she ever picked up a drink. And I remember listening to her and thinking, man, that lady knows how I've lived. I really get it. You know, I really identify with that. And I just fell in love with her. She just had a magic. I just fell in love with her. There's, you know, we're blessed because Alcoholics Anonymous is full of women like that. You just have to find them, but they are there. And men also, but I mean, you know, I'm very blessed that I have been privileged to know some of the finest women, I believe, in Alcoholics Anonymous. So Phyllis had this gift, and she could look around the room and pick out the sickest woman there, and she'd just go right for her, you know. And she came up to me, and she put her arm around me, and she said, baby, you just stick by me, and everything's going to be okay. And I tell you what, I just melted. You know, if she had come up to me and said, you should do this, or you need to do that, or you know, I don't know what would have happened to me. But she didn't do that. She just said, you just come with me. You're going to be fine. She said, you know, I had a daughter. If I had a daughter, she'd be just like you. She'd be really sick. I thought that meant she liked me, you know. I just thought that was so cool. So the next day I was on the beach with Phyllis. Phyllis was so, I got to tell you this part too, she had cancer also. She had colon cancer. And she had had the operation and she had the colostomy bag. And when she talked from the podium that night, she said, it's the most expensive thing I've ever worn and I can't show anyone. She was such a trip, you know. She was so easy with life. She was just easy with life. There was just no big drama going on, you know. That's something that I like. I'm drawn to that. Anyway, I was on the beach with her the next day, and we were laying in the sand and playing around and stuff. And I said, you know, Phyllis, I probably need to do another fourth step, right? And she said, no, baby, you just need to do a first step, you know. And I said, man, I don't get what you mean. I don't know. How do you do a first step? I mean, I am an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable. I got it. And she said, there's implied action in the first step. She said, it says we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable, and the implied action is that you need to find new management She said, you need to find a power greater than you are that will solve your problem. I said, okay, no sweat. She said, all right, then tell me about your higher power. What kind of higher power do you have? So I started telling her about the churches I went to when I was a kid. That's what I know about God. And she interrupted me and she said, wait a minute, let me tell you something. She said, any God that you can understand will be too small for your needs. And I'm like, wow, you know, I'd never heard that before. She said, you've been trying to do this a long time and it's not working. She said, maybe you should consider something else. And I said, like what? Like what else is there? And she said, well, think about this. When you lay down at night and you go to sleep, your lungs inflate and deflate all night long, and your heart beats all night long, and there's nothing that you do before you go to bed that makes that happen. And I said, okay. She said, when your time on this earth is up, there is nothing you could do to add one more minute to your time on this planet. When your time is up, you're gone. And I said, okay. She said, then that is a power greater than yourself. It's something you didn't create, and it's something you can't control. And she said, if you wake up in the morning and you're breathing, then you are a spiritual being and God loves you as if you were his only child. You know, and I can't say that I knew what that meant exactly, but I love the way it sounded. You know, she could have said about 1,000 things, but when she said that only child part, she really had me because I was grieving my kids so bad. I wanted my children back. And I said, well, don't I need to know who God is? I mean, shouldn't I know who I'm turning my life and my will over to? She said, no. She said, it's none of your business who God is. She said, God knows who he is. If you talk to him, he'll answer you. And I said, well, what do I call him? And she said, well, you could call him God. I'm like, whoa, slow down. I said, what do I do? And she said, tonight when you're alone, I want you to get on your knees and say a prayer like this. She said, say it in your own words, but the idea that you want to put out there is something like, God, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you want from me, but if you want anything to do with what's left of my life, then come on, because I don't know where to go from here. And you know, I thought that was probably the most honest prayer I'd ever heard. You know, what she said is whatever the difference between a live body and a dead body is, that's a really big deal. That's something you didn't create. It's something you can't, you know, you can't maintain. You can't keep it here beyond its time. I mean, that is a power greater than yourself. She said, if you ever wake up and you're not breathing, you won't be here. You know, so whatever that essence is that keeps you alive, that is a higher power. That comes from the higher power. It is part of the higher power. So it put me in a brand new place with my life. You know, when she talked about my breath, she said, if you wake up and you're breathing, when I opened my mouth and I inhaled to pray, I could feel the air on the back of my tongue. And it was the first time for me that I ever went within to find a place of peace. And I did. You know, when I would open my mouth and pray like that, I found a place of peace within me. And that was, you know, I'd always been praying to some God out here somewhere that may or may not help me. And this was a brand new place. It was a brand new time. I went back into my meetings in Kona and told them I had a new higher power, and it was my breath. And they said, that's nice, just keep coming back, you know. But you know, it's really cool. In Hawaii, I'm sure a lot of you know that the Hawaiian word for white people is haole. And the origin of that word means, the word haole means man without breath. Because when the white people arrived on the island, they were so pale, they thought they were dead. So they said, they called them haoles, they were men without breath. And I think it's cool, because, you know, here I am in Hawaii, and it just worked for me. It was the beginning for me of a wonderful journey. And to this, you know, for the longest time, it stayed that same kind of prayer. But I was on new footing. I mean, I had new ground under my feet. And I felt like I was a hold of something at last. And I had something that I could believe in. And that has never let me down. My relationship with my higher power has had to change and grow, and you know, it's conformed and definitely different. And in the beginning, it was kind of anything but what was conventional to me to begin with. And now it has almost come back to something that's very similar to what I started out with to begin with in my childhood. as far as my children go, I tried really hard to reinstate my relationship with them, and I tried to, you know, continue to practice principles, and I sent them cards, and I called them, and I, you know, I tried to pursue a relationship with them. And when I was about 2 years sober, I got letters from all of them saying, leave us alone. We don't want to know you. Leave this family alone. And it just killed me. And so for the longest time, there was no communication with the kids at all. And, you know, I got brought to my knees with that surrender over and over and over again. I used to hear people talk about how they, you know, their relationships were mended, and I'd get so jealous about that, but it was just the way it was for me. What ended up happening was 5 years into it, my youngest daughter, well, about 2 years after I got the letters, I got a letter from my youngest daughter, and she agreed to see me. I was living in Southern California, so I would go back to Montana and spend 4 or 5 days with her once a year. And the second year, she would see me, and the middle daughter would see me. And then the third year and the fourth year, nothing. And the fifth year that I went back up there, my son agreed to see me and my oldest daughter. So little by little, they began to come back, but they were angry. And I learned the value of the eighth and ninth step, I'll tell you. I'm very grateful that my sponsors have been very specific about how to make amends, that you don't go into those situations saying that you're sorry. You know, I don't know about you, but I've been sorry all my life, you know. It was kind of like, I'm Donna and I'm sorry. And what they said is that there's a sentence in the big book in the eighth step where it says we confess our former ill feelings and we express our regret. And there is something very honorable about expressing our regret. And they said when you meet those kids, you sit and listen to their experience and you say, yes, you're right. That's the way we lived and I will always regret that we have had those, that's the way we had to live. My only hope is that you will get to know me for who I am now and that eventually we will make a new history. And I had an opportunity to do those things. Boy, and I'll tell you what, it's hard, that's tough work. And to some extent, those relationships have been healed completely, and in other ways, they are still fairly broken. My relationship with my oldest daughter is not a good one, and she paid a real high price for alcoholism. We all paid a high price for alcoholism, but she paid her own price, and you know, she's not been able to let go of very much of that, and I have to respect that. I don't have to, you know, make it right or wrong, but I have to respect that it's her journey. I have to just let her have what, have her stuff. All I know is that I don't live that way anymore. When I went up there to meet with my son, though, my son and my oldest daughter, my son was a brand new member of AA at that time, and he was pouring coffee and reading how it works. And I could see that he was, you know, in there, in AA, going to meetings, trying to be a recovering person, and nothing was happening for him. And when I left up there, he made it about six, he began to drink immediately when I left up there. He picked up a drink, I think, the day after I left. And he made it about 6 months. And he woke up one morning, and it was a, he wrote a note and just said, I can't live like this anymore, and I've been to AA, and it didn't work. And he jumped off the cliffs that surround Billings. And, you know, it put me in a place in my sobriety that, I mean, no one has tools to deal with that kind of thing. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I was lost. I was absolutely lost. I was devastated. I wanted so bad to have an opportunity to make a relationship with my children again. I wanted another chance. I wanted to be able to be the mother that I know that I am. And, you know, to have that opportunity removed from me was just something I never saw coming. And it was a miserable time. My prayer to God at that point, you know, I also began to kind of doubt everything. I began to think like, well, what else can't I depend on, you know? My prayer at that time was, it was more than, you know, what it started out to be with regard to, like, I don't know who you are or what you want from me. It was slightly more than that, but it was nowhere near what it needed to be. It was a time in my life where I needed to find God or I was going to die. And I probably came closer to dying then than at any other time in my whole life. And just from heartache, I wasn't suicidal, but I just felt like it was going to kill me. And there was just no relief from it. And I couldn't seem to, you know, work through it. And I did all the stuff. You know, you can, there are situations that come up in life where you just can't work hard enough to make it better. You know, it's a matter of just living through it. And, you know, I had a lot of locked in ideas about God and God's job. And at this time, I really blamed God for this. Polly was, wasn't my sponsor quite yet. I had a sponsor that died right about the time that Daniel also died. And Polly became my sponsor after that. But I remember one day Polly said to me, "I think you're angry at God." And I said, "I don't want to be angry at God. I'm angry at God." I mean, it doesn't take a scientist to figure out that it doesn't pay to be angry at God. You know, he's not going to feel it, okay? But she said, "You know, I know, baby, but I think you are. I think you're angry at God." I was angry at life, that's for sure. One of my meditation books has a statement in it that says that life breaks our heart again and again and again until it stays open. And that's a concept that it was new to me. I'd never even considered that. When my heart gets broken, my tendency is to close up and to protect myself and to try to, you know, buffer whatever might come next. And it never occurred to me that the whole process of heartbreak is the purpose, the usefulness in that is to come to a place where it's open. 2 years and 9 months after Daniel died, my second daughter Tracy died. And she was 25 years old, and she was 5 years sober, and she was a dynamite little woman in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was just a little bombshell. And she was married and had a little girl of her own, and she got a virus that destroyed her heart in 4 days, and she died. And it was just like, it felt like the end for me. I just felt like, what, you know, what can I possibly bear? What more can there be? You know, there was a divorce that happened shortly after that, and my dad died, and I mean, there was a stretch of about 10 years in there where happy, joyous, and free was not on the menu. I kept going to meetings because I didn't know what else to do, and I was angry, and I prayed a lot, and sometimes I prayed with a lot of anger, but it doesn't really matter. My God has real big shoulders, you know. What I had was a formula in my head. What I was suffering from was that delusion that I could rest satisfaction and happiness if I only managed well. And I had been managing well, dang it. I had been being very, very good. I had been secretary of whatever and sponsoring whoever and speaking when I was asked and showing up for all the service commitments. And I'm being good. And now life is supposed to be good for me. And that was what I suffered from, was that delusion that I'm supposed to get mine. And you know, this was a time when mine wasn't, like I said, it wasn't on the menu. I was at a meeting one night, and I heard a guy talk about a childhood like mine. And what he said was that with 8 years of sobriety, he had this idea in the back of his mind that the reason things like that happened to little boys was if they deserved it. And when he said that, it was like somebody hit me with a bat. I just felt like, oh my God, you know, that's how I feel. That's, you know, I feel like I'm getting what I deserve. And it's hard to describe, but I didn't feel like God was killing my kids to mess with me. But I felt like, what made you think this was going to work for you? You know, when has it ever worked for you? When has life ever been good? I was so locked into that. And I was driving home that night, and this is, you know, this was a profound spiritual experience. I don't know, you know, if I can even convey it, but I was driving home and I turned the corner and the thought went through my mind, what if I've been wrong? It was just a moment of that, you know, maybe it's in the early part of the big book where it talks about, well, this guy said, what if most religious people are right? Where he just has that notion, like, what if I've been mistaken here? That's exactly what happened to me. What if I've been wrong? What if I've been wrong about God? And what if I've been wrong about me? Maybe I'm not just a piece of junk. What if I've been wrong? And I went home that night and I made a deal with God. And my deal was this. I said, I will do anything you want me to do. I will live anywhere, work anywhere. I will do anything. But you've got to give me some peace and you've got to help me to stay sober. And you know, God has done that for me. that's one of the reasons I'm in Georgia this weekend. You know, whenever I get asked to do something, I do it, and I'm happy to do it. My favorite thing to do is to sit down across the table with another woman alcoholic and talk about this program and what happens in our lives. My husband always says my life is none of my business, you know. I know that the life that I live today is only that way because of the grace of a loving God that I didn't understand and wouldn't have no way of even approaching a relationship with had it not been for this program. The way I live today is truly amazing. The God of my understanding does give me peace, and he does give me joy, and he gives me joy, and does give me, you know, I still have sorrow, I still have, I always will. I always say I'm never happy about those things that happen, but I'm really happy for what happened to me because of it. It changed me. It changed me from being a person who had, you know, a very nebulous idea of a higher power to someone who has been on the search for a higher power with great vengeance ever since those experiences happened. I was kind of hard-pressed into that. The way it is for me now is, like I said, my oldest daughter, my relationship with her is as good as it can be from day to day. Sometimes it's better than others. My middle daughter and my youngest daughter, my relationship with them is really good. My youngest daughter fell into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous a year ago in April, and she's sober a year and a half now. And I'm so grateful that AA was there for her when she needed it. And boy, she needed it, and she's got it. She hit the ground running. She is so in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, she can't stand it. She's serving on conference committees, and she's sponsoring people, and she's done her steps, and she's just on fire. And she has two of my little granddaughters, and you know they get to share in the benefits of living a life by a spiritual basis. The youngest of her two children, is nine, and at night before they go to bed, they say the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer and the Third Step Prayer. And she always says that I need to say my prayers, Mom, and that, you know, and they just have this time together. It's such a beautiful thing. You know, I didn't have those kind of things when I grew up, but it's neat to see how Alcoholics Anonymous makes an imprint on the lives of these young children too already. And Andy talks to her about making amends and stuff. I mean, situations come up from time to time where she feels like she blew it, and she's full of guilt and remorse, and she's very dramatic, and she's crying, what will I do, and I did something wrong, and you know, and Andy will talk to her about making amends, how you have to go by what you feel inside when it comes to making amends, and keeping it really simple. It's neat to see how this legacy is passed on from generation to generation. And Andy, my youngest daughter, tells me that I have been something that she has watched as an example for 24 years, and you know, you don't even know they're watching. And yet, you know, they are learning and they are watching. And I'm so grateful for that. About 6 years ago, I was in an AA meeting speaking, and in walked God's will for my life. But this time it's different. I was in this meeting, and this cowboy walked in the door, and I looked at him and went, oh my God. Whoa, who is that? And he is just a tall, gorgeous, he's 6'4", big old cowboy, nice hat, belt buckle, boots, the Wranglers, the whole deal, you know? And I love cowboys. I mean, there's just, I can't stand it. I love cowboys. But I looked at him and went, that is awesome. That is one good looking man right there. Well, he turned out that he had a girlfriend. And, you know, whatever. So I just kept my mouth shut. No. I'm good. I keep my mouth shut. I didn't say anything to anybody. I just kept my little secret. And I went home that night, though, and I told my mom. I said, I met this guy. He's the guy. Boy, he's the right. He's got everything I want. And so anyway, over a period of about 2 years, every once in a while, I would ask about Bob and Linda. How are Bob and Linda doing? And my friends would say, oh, they're good, or whatever. And I'd say, oh, that's nice, you know. I just didn't tell anybody. Then I got offered a job in Northern California, and so I was packing up and leaving Montana again. And one of my friends said, hey, by the way, Bob and Linda aren't together anymore. Do you want me to hook you up? And I said, No, just forget it. Just let God do whatever. So I went ahead and moved to Northern California. And I ended up having an experience down there that was just a surrender of a whole new level, which we continue to have as long as we stay sober. But anyway, I had that experience down there, and I was invited to speak at a conference up in Montana. So I came back up to Montana to speak at this conference, and Bob was the host of the speakers. And that was in September, and we got married in January. Needless to say, he wasn't busy when I saw him up there. And I took care of that. We were talking to Lee from Lee's tapes. We were telling Lee. Lee knows Bob real well. They're good friends. And I was telling Lee about it, and Lee kept saying, "Speed kills," you know. I was like, man, I didn't see something I want. I'm not waiting around. Anyway, you know, we have a beautiful life, and he is real life, and he is really in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he served as delegate for the state of Montana. He runs around and speaks all over the country just like I do, and we've got a house full of guys and women that are coming and going all the time, and, you know, we live on a farm out in the country, and we just have a beautiful, beautiful AA life, and, you know, I'm so grateful that I get to enjoy this life, and, you know, I am so grateful for my sobriety today, and I am so grateful for all of it, for all of it. You know, in spite of what has gone on, I would rather be me than anybody I know. And when I got here, I wanted to be anybody but me. I wanted to be anybody but who I was. So I am really looking forward to the rest of today, and thank you so much for your time and attention this morning.
That was wonderful.